I've spoken many times in Queens to the Bukhari community there. I remember they advertised the first one I did. They advertised it for 8 o'clock. I turned up at 7:45, and we started at 9:15. I steadily started coming later and later and later. And so now when they advertise for 8 o'clock, it's in Queens, I turn up at 9 and I wait around for a little bit and I start. Rabbi Ruckenberg assured me that in Brooklyn the Bukharian community starts more or less on time. So I got here at 8:25. I just have to adjust myself to the various communities. Now, I was lecturing down in Dallas, Texas a while ago, and a guy kept asking me questions about the Bible, the Bible. And he said, Rabbi, the Bible says this, the Bible says that. And I said, look, I'm an Orthodox rabbi. I don't believe in the Bible. It's not really that relevant to be asking me questions about it. And he was a little shocked. What do you mean, Orthodox rabbi, I don't believe in the Bible? I said, of course not. I said, you see, we believe in what's called Torah. Torah and Bible are two different things. What you see of Judaism in the Bible, meaning, when you say Bible, what you mean is the literal Christian fundamentalist translation of the 5 books of Moses. What I see of Torah is much more than that. In fact, what we see of Torah in the Bible is the tip of the iceberg of Judaism. The vast bulk of it is actually beneath the surface. It's actually the Mishnah, the Talmud, the Zohar, the Sifri, the Sifra, thousands of pages of information. So what I'd like to address in this class really is three basic questions. The first question is, how do we know it's there? How do we know there is such a thing as an oral law? How do we know there's a Torah Shebaal Peh? Maybe there's nothing but the Bible. Maybe that's all there is. How do I know there's anything more? Question number two is, what's the advantage? Why not write it all down? Why not write everything? Anyone being involved in the contract? Being involved in contract problems, if you didn't write it down, you are lost. So why didn't God write it down? He didn't have Jewish lawyers. I mean, to write it down would be a simple thing. That is question number two. Question number three is, maybe the message got distorted. You know how rumours go? Someone tells you a rumour, it gets distorted along the way. So maybe the message of the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, maybe it got distorted along the way. So in terms of the first one, first of all, let me tell you something very obvious, which is that Hebrew is the exact opposite of Hawaiian. I know that's obvious, but let me just explain a little bit. Right, Hawaiian is almost all vowels, that type of thing, right? Hebrew is no vowels. Hebrew is consonants. In order to get the vowel and the sounds in Hebrew, you need the little dots and dashes. We need the nekudot in order to tell me how to pronounce a word, and it makes a big difference. Just for example, I don't know if you can see this, but can anyone see this word, the first word there? Can you see the first word there? How would you pronounce that? Chalav. The Torah says, Kol chetlamadei lo tochelu. Don't eat this. There's a verse in the Torah that says, don't eat this. So if you pronounce it chalav, that means the Torah is telling you, don't eat milk. Is that correct? You're not allowed to have milk? Ever? But however, how should that be read? Anyone? Chalav. Chalav is a type of fat found around the kidneys of an animal. How about the next one? Can you read the next one? Anyone read the next one? Yireh. Yireh means he will see. Yirah means he will fear. Yorah means he will show. Yireh means he will appear. Which one is it? It's a little difficult. Here the Torah says, if you want to purify yourself, it says, Berachatzet b'saro, wash yourself. How would you read that? Ba'mayim. Can anyone translate the word ba'mayim? Not in water. That's incorrect. The word b'mayim does not mean in water, it means? Nope. B'mayim means in water. B'mayim means in the water. What's the difference between saying in water and the water? If I say wash yourself in water, that could be the jacuzzi. That could be a shower. That could be it could be anything. When I say the water, we are referring to very, very specific water. So what I'm pointing out is, in order to read the Torah, there's no vowels. How do we know how to pronounce it? In fact, how do the Christians, when the Christians and the Muslims, when they read the Torah, when they translate it, whose pronunciation are they relying upon? They're relying upon our pronunciation. Our pronunciation comes from the Torah Shebaal Peh, from the oral tradition. So therefore, number one, just in order to read the Torah, you have to have an oral tradition. Number two, for punctuation. There's a book I recently bought my wife. It is called Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. Anyone heard of the book? It's a book on English grammar. It was a bestseller, believe it or not. The cover of the book has a picture of a panda, and the panda is erasing a comma. The comma appears in the sentence, eats, comma, shoots, and leaves. Now, here, a little concentration here. If there's a comma in the sentence, eats, comma, shoots, and leaves, what does it tell you about pandas? It tells you that a panda eats, comma, shoots, bam, bam, and then leaves. Okay? However, if there's no comma, what does it tell you? Pandas eat shoots, which are small little pieces of bamboo, and leaves, which are large green things. Is the difference clear? Right, grammar is very, very, punctuation, very important. Hebrew, the Torah, has no punctuation whatsoever. So, for example, when you see a sign, there was actually a story of a telegram that Stalin got from Trotsky. Trotsky was Stalin's worst enemy, and Stalin got a telegram from Trotsky. At least he claimed he got a telegram from Trotsky. He reads out the telegram the following way. He says, "I just got a telegram from my greatest enemy." He reads it out, "Dear Stalin, I was wrong, you were right, I should apologize, signed Trotsky." So everyone claps because they don't want to die. But basically, a Jew in the audience says, "May I please read this with greater emotion?" Stalin says, "Of course." So the Jew comes up, takes the telegram, and he reads it like this. "Dear Stalin, I was wrong, you were right, I should apologize, Trotsky." Which is slightly different depending on your emphasis. We were in Ein Gedi, and we saw the following sign. It said, we're swimming, and the sign says, "No swimming allowed." Security guard comes over and says, "What are you doing swimming here?" I said, "Swimming, like, what's the problem?" He said, "Can't you read the sign? It says no swimming allowed." I said, "I didn't read it that way. I read it differently." "No, swimming allowed." Right, so it's a little bit different, right? My daughter saw the following sign in New Jersey. "Fine for littering." So she said, "Oh, that's great. Wow, it's fine for littering." But you see, you have to understand, when you don't have punctuation, you run into problems. The Torah has no punctuation. Where do we get the punctuation from in the text of the Torah? Anyone know where we get punctuation from in the Torah? The answer is the oral tradition. Because when we read the Torah in the synagogue, we don't read it. We actually sing it. And the singing notes that we use for the Torah actually provide punctuation. They tell you where to stop. They tell you where to start. They tell you continuation. They tell you emotion. There's a tremendous amount we learn from that. So therefore, number one, to read the Torah, you've got to have the vowels. You've got to hear someone read it to know how to pronounce it. Secondly, in order to read, even if you can figure out how to read the Torah, you've still got to have punctuation to know when to stop and when to start, etc. One of the legal definitions. Example. The Torah says don't work on Shabbat, but the Torah doesn't define what work is. If you studied physics, you would know that what is work?
Force
times displacement. W equals FD. W equals FD. If you work for the IRS, right, you would say what is work? Anything you get paid for. If you test suntan lotions on the beach in Acapulco, they want your money, all of it. That's called work. Right, what is work? How do you define work? I remember a guy telling me, he says, "I only want to do the Ten Commandments." I said, "Fantastic, I wish everyone would do the Ten Commandments." He said, "Really?" I said, "Yes." I said, "What do you plan to do about Shabbat?" He wasn't aware that it was in there. So he said, so you have to think quickly. He said, "You know what, whatever you do during the week for a living, don't do that on Shabbat." He said, "That's what it means, that's the definition." I said, "Interesting. So, supposing I have a good friend who works for the government in a think tank. So what does he do during the week? He thinks. What should you do on Shabbat? Put himself in a drug-induced stupor for 24 hours? Watch television for 24 hours so he does not think? Right? I mean, what is the idea? The answer is, you've got to have a definition. For example, the Torah says, on the 10th day of the 7th month, what day is that? 10th day, 7th month. Yom Kippur. Day of Atonement. The Torah says, what does it say to do? It says, what does that mean? You shall afflict your soul. Now, what does it mean to afflict your soul? Read Russian novels, roll around on thumbtacks, do both simultaneously? It doesn't say in the Torah what it means when it says afflict your soul. We know what it means is don't eat, don't drink, etc. But that is from the oral tradition. And there's so many things in the Torah where the Torah doesn't define what it actually means. The Torah basically leaves us as if We have no definition for these things. So there's one place the Torah actually says, you shall slaughter of your flocks and your cattle as I have commanded you. Interesting to note, nowhere in the entire Torah does God tell us how to kill an animal. He just says, kill it, shed it, as I commanded you. Doesn't say how to do it. Machine gun the thing, strangle it, beat it to death. It does not say how to do it. Bore it, it does not say. But it does say, slaughter it as I commanded you. Evidently, there are commands somewhere other than the Torah in which God tells us exactly how to do it. So the way I understand the relationship between the written Torah and the oral Torah is like notes and the lecture. Right, that's to say, I'll just give you an example. Anyone study chemistry? I'm sure there's some people who study chemistry. Okay, if I told you the word knackle, what would that mean? Knackle. N-A-C-L. N-A-C-L. Salt. A-U.
Gold.
P-B. Lead. Very good. Right, so now, but let's say you're sitting there, you've just heard a chemistry lecture. And you're sitting there in the school cafeteria reading the notes of a fascinating chemistry lecture, if such a thing is possible. Right? And you're sitting there reading it, like that, and you've written it in the shorthand that you might use in chemistry. Right? So a friend of yours, English literature major, comes over and says, you look fascinated by that lecture. I go, oh, yeah, it was the best one of the year. So he says, can I please read the notes? I said, sure. He takes the notes, he starts reading. Knackle or... Right, and he says, you've been drinking the chemicals? This makes no sense whatsoever. Now, what is this person's problem? I mean, aside from being an English lit major, what are their other problems? Right, the problem is the following. That they didn't hear the lecture and they don't know the shorthand. So, for example, when did we hear the oral law, the Torah Shofet, that's the whole lecture. When did the Jewish people hear that lecture? In the 40 years of the desert. Think of it. Almost every single event in the desert happened in the first year and the last year. So in the middle of 38 years, what are the Jews doing? They're walking out of the desert. Beautiful sand dune, isn't it gorgeous? Right? It reminds me of the one we saw yesterday, and the day before, the day before, the day before, and 38 years. I mean, what do they do? Going out of their minds with boredom? I mean, the food is there, right? Clothing is supplied. Everything's supplied. The answer is they're listening, they're hearing, they're learning the oral tradition. Now, the Torah Shevetah, the written law, are the written notes of the oral tradition. That means if you heard the lecture and I tell you one of the little codes of it, you'll know what I'm talking about. If I would walk up to a total stranger in a bar and say, put a sign between your frontlet between your eyes and a sign on your arm. Right? So after I go to the hospital, what exactly? I mean, you understand? What would he think? I say, put a frontlet between your eyes. Tie a sign on your arm, put frontlets between your eyes. Anyone know what that means? I'm sure you all know what that means. What does it mean? Fill in. But if you haven't heard the lecture, if you're not familiar with the oral law, and I tell you put a sign between your eye, what would you do? Go to a tattoo parlor? I'd like a mugging dog right there. Thank you very much. What does that mean? The answer is that there is a relationship of notes to a lecture. So, for example, today, if you would, anyone know this symbol here? Here, it's. When I was a kid in school, see this symbol here? One second. I don't know if you can see it. That symbol there. See that symbol? It's the at symbol. Now, you see, when I learned typing when I was a kid, we did not learn that symbol. There was absolutely no use for it. No one ever used it. I didn't learn touch typing that symbol. But no, we didn't have, I don't know if you can conceive of this, but we did not have email. Right? So no one used that symbol. Now, today, if you don't know what that symbol is, you must be living in a cave. I mean, even people in caves have email. Right? So what is that symbol? The answer is, it's at. Right? So there are certain symbols, right? Or for instance, if you write on a text message, right? If you do a semicolon and then a parenthesis, what have you done? Well, a smile. You can tell a geek because they're working like this. Right? But I'm saying the idea here is that the Torah, the five books of Moses, compared to the oral law, are like lecture notes to an entire lecture. When you've heard the lecture, the Torah makes sense. If you haven't heard the lecture, the Torah doesn't make any sense. So therefore, the answer to our first question is that the Torah was never meant to be a standalone book. It wasn't meant to be a book just by itself. It was given together with numerous oral traditions. The punctuation, the pronunciation, the definitions of laws, The ideas behind everything is the essence of what it's about. So that's what we mean when we talk about the oral law. Now, the second question we have is, why not write everything down? Why not write the whole thing down? Wouldn't it make more sense that if God would write everything down? Well, there's a few answers to this. Number one, we're in 2a. Almost every system of knowledge has an oral law. I've asked physicians, I've asked doctors the following question. Where did you learn more about medicine? First 4 years of college or when you actually started working in the hospital? Most of them tell me when they started working in the hospital. I've asked lawyers, where did you learn more about law? When you're actually in the first 4 years of law school or when you started working in a law firm in the summer? They answer, when I was working in the law firm. Example, anyone here know how to swim? Put up your hand if you know how to swim. Everyone, right? Good, excellent. Excellent, put your hands down. Anyone here who learned how to swim from a book, please put up your hand. I have asked this question all over the world of literally thousands of people. No one has ever put up their hand saying, yes, I learned how to swim from a book. Do you know why? Because tragically, the people who learned how to swim from a book are no longer with us. There are certain things you don't learn from books. How to live life, you don't learn from a book. How to tie your shoelace. Everyone knows how to tie a shoelace. I mean, I assume not everyone here has got Velcro shoes, right? So did your parents hand you a list of instructions? Here you go. Right? No, just follow the instructions. I mean, I have a friend who used to teach English at university, and he gave an assignment to his class. Everyone in class had to write written instructions of how to tie your shoelace, and then switch it with everyone else. And then you had to tie your shoelace both totally on the written instructions of the other person. He says, at the end of the class, they had to call in emergency services. People were hanging, people were tied up to each other. It was horrific, right? No one could tie the stupid shoelace. The answer is, there's a lot of things that have to be learnt from another person, not from a book. And in fact, some of the most important things in life come via an oral tradition, not only in Torah, but in every area. What is the difference between Harvard University, Oxford University on the one hand, and Texas A&M on the other? I mean, they can all get the same textbooks. Just go to Amazon and you can get the textbooks. What's the big deal? The answer is the oral tradition, i.e., who is teaching, with whom you are interacting, who you talk to, who you ask questions of, who answers your questions, oral law. Very, very major. So number one advantage is that the Torah is not just teaching us facts, it is teaching us a way of life and skills, and a way of life and the skills of life are not learned from books, they're learned from an oral tradition. 1A. 2B, it is a portable and compact. When you send, at least it used to be this way, if you send a long email to someone, what should you do before you send the email? Compress it. Right? Compress it. Otherwise, right, it takes ages. It locks up the system. The person's sitting there looking at their BlackBerry. Right? So they go catatonic. Right? And the idea is the Torah is actually compressed. The Torah has been with us all over the world. We've been thrown out of many countries, right? We've been to many countries, but we always have the Torah with us because everything else can ultimately be derived from the Torah. So the oral Torah is like the decompressed file, and the Torah itself is like a compressed file. C, it is harder to steal than the written word. I was in London just actually 2 weeks ago. But the first time I was in London, I spoke at a college in London called University College of London. And the chaplain there took me into the religion department. And there are posters all over the wall, the religion department. One poster has got the Ten Commandments of Judaism. There's another poster with the Eight Paths to Nirvana. Buddhism, not the rock group. There's another poster which says the Five Pillars of Islam, etc. So I looked at the posters, and the one with the principles of Christianity. So I looked at the posters, I said to the chaplain, you've got a few mistakes on the posters. He said, I beg your pardon. I said, you've got a few mistakes. He says, and I've heard you. I said, look, first of all, Judaism, we don't have 10 commandments, we have 613. We should get a lot more wall space than you've given us. I detect a little bit of anti-Semitism here. Right? I said, I'm only joking. I said, but secondly, under Christianity, the first principle you have of Christianity is love your neighbour as yourself. I said, that's a Jewish principle. He said, no. It's in Matthew 6. I said, actually, it's in Leviticus 19, which was thousands of years before Matthew 6. And I said, not only that, but it's misquoted in Matthew. Because I said, if you look at Matthew, what it says there is, you have heard it said, love your neighbour and hate your enemy. I tell you, turn the other cheek. First of all, does the Torah say hate your enemy?
No.
What does the Torah say? Love your neighbor as yourself. What's the end of the verse? Love your neighbor as yourself. I am God. It doesn't say hate your enemy. I said, and secondly, there they say, don't hate your enemy, resist not evil, turn the other cheek. I said, when have they ever turned the other cheek? The only time they've ever said turn the other cheek is after they've just hit a Jew on one cheek and they say, do you mind turning the other cheek? Thank you very much. Right? But I mean, so it was stolen. What happened to love your neighbours? If you ask anyone on the street, obviously not in Borough Park, but if you go actually outside Brooklyn, where there are Gentiles, and you ask anyone on the street, right, who said love your neighbour as yourself, what will they tell you? They won't say Moses. They will say Jesus said it. It was stolen from us. So much of the written Torah has been distorted and stolen, etc. That has not happened to the oral Torah. You know why? Because for so many years, the oral Torah, where did it exist? Was it on paper? No, it was in here and here. It was in the hearts and minds of the Jewish people. If something's in my mind, you can't steal it. If I write it down, already you can take it away. If I say it, you can take it away. But if it's in my mind, if it exists in the hearts and minds of Jewish people, it's very hard to steal it. So that a second or a third advantage of the oral law is that it's much harder to steal and distort than the written law. Now, in addition, the study ethic. Something we have to understand here is Jews have done very, very well in all academic fields, as you probably know. The Jewish people are three times more likely to go to an Ivy League college than anyone else. We do extremely well in academia. Nobel Prizes coming out of our noses. So exactly why is that? So I think one of the reasons for that is we have what's called a study ethic. That means there's a mitzvah for us to study. But you see, it's been transferred to other areas. But the idea that we have a mitzvah to study is very, very unique. Because you see, it's part of the oral law. If everything's written down, what do you need to do to preserve it? You just need to have a nice bookcase and dust it occasionally. Right? If the Torah is oral, what do you need to do to preserve it? You need to study it. You need to study it. If you don't study it. And it's an amazing thing. I read a story about a scholar who was in Warsaw before the Second World War. He was looking for a taxi. He's in a Jewish area. He's looking for a taxi. The taxis there were horse-drawn carriages. So there's a few taxis lined up. There's no taxi drivers in sight. The guy sees a little Jewish kid and he says, excuse me, where are the taxi drivers? The kid says, I'll show you. He takes him into a small synagogue and the Jewish taxi drivers are sitting around studying Mishnah in their time off. Now, he was amazed. Why? Because I have heard taxi drivers take time off to pray. I've heard of their passengers praying fervently. But the idea that taxi drivers will actually take time off to study is incredible. Imagine if you're in Fifth Avenue, New York, you're near the New York Public Library, you are looking for a yellow cab. There's no yellow cabs in sight. And you see, lined up outside the public library, a whole line of yellow cabs. And there's a kid standing there watching the cabs. So you walk over to the kid, you say your best New York English, sup dog, I need to get back to my hood, so where are my peeps are not here with me, and so I need to get a taxi. Where are the drivers of the taxis? So he says, I'll show you. He takes me into the New York Public Library, and there, sitting around a table in the New York Public Library, all the taxi drivers of New York are sitting around studying the Constitution of the United States of America. How likely do you think this is? I mean, first of all, if they're going to study anything, they should study English, they should study personal hygiene, and they should study driving. Right? But the idea that they're studying the Constitution, however, for Jews, this is not unusual. It's not unusual for us to take off time and to study. The beauty of that actually comes from the oral tradition. The fact that we take off time to study, the fact that we invest ourselves in it, not just rabbis, but anyone, not just clergy, but anyone, right, that's a very beautiful idea. That comes from the oral law. Number 2e, there's a necessity of personal contact with those who give out the tradition. That's an important thing. We believe if it's all in a book, you don't need to go to a person. And if you don't need to go to a person, you don't have a contact with the previous generation. We feel it's important to have a contact with the previous generation. The fact that the Torah, so much of it is transmitted verbally, orally, is very important because what it means is it forces us to have contact with the previous generation. In many areas of knowledge, you don't want contact with the guy teaching. You know what I mean? Bertrand Russell, famous British philosopher, was teaching at the City College of New York. And he was teaching a course in the ethics of relationships. The ethics of relationships. At the time he was teaching the course, it was rumored that he had relationships with two of his students. So you understand, he's teaching a course in the ethics of relationships, and of course he has relationships with two students. Not exactly ethical. So a student comes over to him and says, "Lord Russell, how can you teach a course in the ethics of relationships and act in such an unethical fashion?" He says, "My dear fellow, is the geometry professor a triangle?" He can teach geometry without being a triangle. I can teach ethics without being ethical. What's the big deal? That's how he understood it. In Jewish tradition, we say very differently. We say you're supposed to learn from what the person does as well as from what they say. And the oral law is a way of ensuring that contact with the previous generation. 2F, anti-superficiality device. When you read something, then there is, you know, very often a person will just read it and understand it on a superficial level. The way the Torah is organized, it's organized in such a way that when you read the Torah, you never can understand it superficially. If you understand it superficially, you have not understood it. The oral law always, you know, when anyone, a Jew looks at the Torah, you know what they start doing? Their thumb starts twitching, right? And the eye, you narrow your eyes and say, oh, and you start asking questions. That's a good thing. Because what it means is, I'm not going to read it on a superficial level, I'm going to understand it on a deeper level. In addition, there's a feedback mechanism. When I have something verbally, there's feedback. When there is something which is written, there's no feedback. I don't know if you understand it. If I give you a book, you read the book, I don't know if you understood it. But if I'm talking to you, and then you talk back to me, and I ask a question, you ask a question, then there is interaction, and then I can know there's feedback as to whether you understand it. Finally, there is the Tai Chi principle of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Anyone know what Tai Chi is? Tai Chi is a Chinese martial art. It's a martial art which is used, they do it slowly as a form of exercise. Actually, it's a martial art. So there's a story, there was a Tai Chi master who was teaching his students a particular thing in Tai Chi known as a Tai Chi turn, which basically is very simple. You have to get up and do this. It's basically very simple, it's just like that. It's a very relaxing thing to do. Your feet are planted firmly, and you just swing. It just swing like that. Swing. So the students ask him, "Excuse me, but may I please ask Sensei why we are swinging? Right, what's the purpose of this turn?" So he said very simple. It's in order to change enough to stay the same. They said, "What are you talking about? Change enough to stay the same." So he walks over to a student, and he pushes him in the shoulder. And the guy, like, falls back. And he pushes another student, and the student pushes his shoulder forward, and he hurts him, right? So the teacher says, now, he says, if you do a Tai Chi turn, he says, and you are pushed in the shoulder, he says, if you push back and someone pushes you in the shoulder, then basically you are off balance. If they're stronger, you'll fall over or you'll get hurt. He says, if you're pushed in the shoulder and you just do that, he says, then what happens is you've changed enough to stay the same. So the person who pushes you, he's the one who's off balance, and you are fine. So as he pushes you, I turn. He says you can accompany the turn with the hand behind the neck and the knee in the face, right? But the basic idea is the Tai Chi turn. So now the principle here is the Torah Shebaal Peh, because it is for so many years it was not written down, had within it a certain flexibility. That is to say, the sages of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Supreme Court, in every generation, were able to take it and apply it as their minds understood the situation, and apply it with some flexibility. Once it's written down, it's very inflexible. But at the time that it wasn't written down, there was a wonderful level of certain flexibility, not total flexibility, but there was enough flexibility to change enough to stay the same. I'll give you an example. According to the Torah, if you look in the Bible, what is the system of education that the Torah recommends? What type of school does the Torah recommend? Anyone know? Read through the Bible. What type of school does it recommend?
Yeshiva.
Nope. It's a trick question, as most rabbis' questions are. Right? It's a trick question. The Torah does not recommend any school whatsoever. It says you should teach your children. That's what it says. It says the parents should teach their children. No schools are mentioned in the Torah ever. So in fact, the ideal method of education was parent to child. However, during the time of when the Romans destroyed the temple, just after that period, the Jews were in exile. The Jews who were in Israel, there was a lot of poverty, there were a lot of orphans, there was a lot of problems. And so people were not learning Torah. The education system wasn't working. So a rabbi by the name of Yeshua ben Gamla made a decree that we should establish schools. The child from age 6 to 7 until age 15 or 16 should go to school. And every city should have a school. In other words, that's a revolutionary concept. But it was a revolutionary concept, but it was a Tai Chi idea. Meaning, he changed enough to stay the same. Is this clear so far? Okay. So that answers, therefore, our second question. What are the advantages of not writing it down? We have now answered that. We now come to our third question. The third question is the obvious question, which is what we call broken telephone. Anyone play broken telephone at school? I know in America that probably means vandalising the public phone, right? But that's not... In Australia, when we talk about broken telephone, what we mean is the following. The teacher whispers a message to one student. The student passes it on to the next student, and to the next student, to the next student, and then the last student writes down what he heard on the board. What happens, what always happens to that message? Is it the same as the message the teacher gave?
No.
Never. You know, the teacher gives one message, on the board will be something totally different. So people often ask, well, hold on. So Moses says to Joshua, pass this on. Right? Oh my gosh. Right? And he tells him this, and that was like, how long was the Torah oral? The Torah was oral for approximately 1,500 years. So you had 1,500 years of people saying, pass it on. Right? Surely there must be many, many distortions, correct? Is that a good question? Okay. I think it's a good question. Okay. How do we answer this? So first of all, let's go back to the school scenario. You have to think a little bit about this, I'm sorry. Right? The school scenario is the following. Instead of having one group of kids passing on the message, let's pretend we have 100 children in the class. And you divide them into 10 groups of 10. The teacher whispers the same message to the leader of each group. And then all the groups pass down the message, and then the last person writes down what they heard. Do you think that will increase my chances of knowing the original message, or decrease?
Increase.
Those who said increase are correct. It would increase my chances. I'll tell you why. I'll explain why. Let's say the teacher gave the following message. A, B, C, D. What did I say?
A, B, C, D.
A, B, C, D. So I tell the first person in each group, A, B, C, D. So now one kid in the group, one group, they get it correct. They say A, B, C, D. They're the nerds in the group. They'll get beaten up at recess. But they all get it correct. They pass on A, B, C, D. Okay. And there's a few groups of nerds. They all get it right. Then you've got some other kid. The only thing he's ever heard from an adult is ADHD. So he says, I think they said ADHD, right? And then he passes on, so they've got ADHD. Then there's another kid who his parents are all-time rock and roll fans. So all he hears is AC/DC, right? You've probably never heard of AC/DC, but okay, right? He hears AC/DC. There's another kid who's German. So instead of saying ABCD, he thinks it was ABCD, three. Yeah, you know, it's three. ABCD, so he's a German, right? So he thinks it's AB3D. And then there's another kid, right, who's never heard the beauty and the poetry of an Australian accent. So this little idiot thinks, instead of saying A, I said I. So I, in fact, didn't say I said A, right? So he writes down IBCD. So, but now, however, at the end of all of this, you know what you're going to have? You're going to have a chart. And on the chart, you can fill in what each group said. You know what you'll see? You'll see the following. 9 out of 10 said the first letter is A. And 8 out of 10 said the second letter is B. And 8 out of 10 said the third letter is C. And 9 out of 10 said the fourth letter is D. In other words, what was, you'll be able to figure out using probability what the original message was, which was ABCD. Am I making myself clear?
Yeah.
So if you transmit it over multiple paths, if I want to get a message to someone, right, let's say you've got obsessive compulsive disorder. I don't want to insult anyone with obsessive compulsive disorder because then they'll write a letter to me about it and then they'll send me a fax and email and phone me, etc. But you know, let's say you've got, and then do it again, right, and then you can check the stove and then do it again. But what you see, if I want to send you a message to make sure you get it, I will, first of all, call you at your home phone number. I will call you at your office phone number. I will leave a message on your cell phone. I will text you. I will email you. I will send you a telegram. I'll send you a FedEx parcel. I'll send you a balloon gram. I'll send you a gorilla gram. Right? I will send you a singing telegram. And I will send you a registered letter. Now, at the end of all this, you'll probably hate me, but you'll get the message. Right? So you see, the idea is when you have multiple lines of transmission, you ensure the message gets through and you can figure out what the original message was. How many lines of transmission did we have of the oral tradition? If you think about it. How many lines of transmission? Thousands. Every family. Every family. I know people, my wife, for example, right, know her fairly well, right, they keep kosher and they've been basically keeping kosher for thousands of years. Right, and a lot of the people in the family did not learn how to keep kosher from a book. My mother-in-law learned how to keep kosher from her mother. She learned how to bake challah and how to take the challah from the dough from her mother. Right, her mother did not learn it from a book or in school because at the time that her mother, in other words, my wife's grandmother was a little girl, there were no schools for girls. So she learned this from who? From her mother, all the way down. So my daughter, who's named after her, is learning how to take challah from the dough from my wife. That means they've got oral tradition going all the way back. That's what we call, have you ever heard the term BT? BT is a Baal Tshuva, someone who's returned to Judaism. FFB, from birth. There's also FFS, from Sinai. Right? There are people basically being religious since Sinai. There is also FFT, which is from Tuesdays, right? But basically, you've got the people have been doing this in Sinai. In other words, every single family is really another chain of the oral tradition. Now, when Judah the prince wrote down the Mishnah, what he did was he didn't just look at one chain. He looked at the results. He looked at the entire chart. And he looked at every single one of the chains. And they went and they judged based on the idea of the majority rule. And they figured out what the original oral law was. So in other words, we have a transmission process, which is a security mechanism of independent transmission over multiple chains. That is number one. 3B. How can I ensure the message? If I tell you a message just out of the blue, unexpected, then you might not remember it. But if the message is ingrained in you from the time you're a little baby, of course you'll remember it. When does a child start learning about the oral Torah? Average religious Jewish home, when does the child learn about the Torah, oral Torah? As soon as she opens her eyes. How do I know that? Example. So the little baby and her first Shabbat at home, she sees candles. And she's like, she's the candles, right? And she hears people saying Shabbat Shalom. And then someone puts their finger in her mouth with wine. And she says, all right, the Shabbos thing's cool, right? And, but she's basically creating this association. We've got an association. We've got candles and wine and Shabbat Shalom. And she smells the challah or whatever it is, etc. In other words, they're already learning, right? By the time my youngest is 6 years old, he knows a tremendous amount about Judaism. He has, most of which he has not learned from a book, he has learned from living it. Very simple. That's the oral tradition. So it's ingrained in you from the time you're a child. It's very hard to forget it. 3C. It's a logical system. We can reconstruct it using its rules. Meaning, it's not a random system. If I give you a random series of numbers, and you forget one of the numbers, you know, like you get sometimes telephone messages. I often get these. You get someone who gives you a message which is so slow, you know, especially if you're on Rome. Right, so you know, like they got this message, hi Rabbi, I was at your lecture 8 years ago, and I was sitting in the second row from the back on the right. It was in New York somewhere. I hope you remember me, right? Anyway, I wanted to ask you slowly, I wanted to ask you a question, and I'm thinking to myself, well, ask the question, leave me a phone number or something. Anyway, I just wanted to know if you could possibly call back if it's not too much of a problem. Anyway, my number is... Right, and then suddenly the medication kicked in or something. I don't know. Suddenly it's like the telephone number is the speed of light. You know what I mean? So you hear six numbers. You don't hear all the numbers. So, you know, sometimes if it's a logical thing, you can work it out. If they're from Brooklyn and they said 7-1 and I didn't hear the 8, I could probably figure out... guess the third number is probably 8. Okay, you know, if they're in Manhattan and they said 2-1, And I can hear it's probably 2, 1, 2. But what if it's random? What if it's an arbitrary series of numbers? Then if I forget the number, it's gone. However, the Torah is not arbitrary or random. It's based on rules of logic. It's based on rules of hermeneutic rules, etc. And therefore, I can figure out things even if they're lost. We can see if it fits in, if it doesn't fit in, just like you do on the SATs. Right, now, 3D, centrality of the message. The message is very central. You see, if you have a message which is trivial, of course you forget it. One of my kids, I remember, he always used to complain, he still complains about it, he's 18 now, but when he was about, when he was young, like he was like 13, whatever, he always used to forget his homework and stuff. He'd forget it at school, he'd forget this at school, forget that at school, right? He says, I've just got a bad memory, I've got a bad memory. So he started going to judo class. After 2 classes, he could count to 20 in Japanese. He could name every single stance in Japanese. He could, you know, Zengutsu, Dachi, this, Dachi, and the whole works. I said, here's the guy with the lousy memory, now speaks fluent Japanese after 2 classes of judo, right? It's unbelievable. So the answer is very simple. Homework is low on the list of priorities. Judo is high on the list of priorities. It's very simple, right? Things which are important to you, you tend not to forget. If we were running a hedge fund here, right, I'd give a class of a hedge fund, every now and again someone gets a phone call, oh really? Okay, yeah, we'll short it, okay, right. And he calls someone else, and that's it. Now he's not going to say, was that short or not? Was that buy or sell? Was it IBM or ICI? You're not going to forget stuff like that because you stand to make a lot of money, right? That's very high on the list of priorities. They don't forget it. They do forget things like their wife's anniversary. They do forget, oh, their anniversaries too, right? But they do forget stuff like that. But it depends on the priorities. The Torah is very important to us. We don't forget it. There are written references, meaning people could make private notes of the Torah. And we also have the Torah, prophets, and writings. So the Torah is not completely oral. There are written references. You could write private notes. In addition, review, mnemonic devices, rhymes, and techniques. In ancient times, before there were palm pilots, before there were Blackberries, before there were PDAs, how did people remember things? Anyone know? No, before then, they used something called their memory. Right, their brain. Right, actually in the ancient world, people had to memorize a lot of things. Because if you were a businessman in Rome, how could you remember stuff? You'd walk around with this like heavy stone brick, heavy stone, and a metal stylus. You walk around like this. So when do you want to meet? 8th of March? Yeah, no problem. Right, and then, you know, and this is all in Roman numerals, you know, ICMCXXX, what it said. I mean, it's insane. People used to have things in scrolls. A scroll is lousy for finding stuff. You have to scroll through the whole thing to find anything. It's not like a book. The book is fantastic. So in days when it was not easy to record information, people used to actually use memory techniques. They used to use their brains, and there were very highly developed memory techniques. When I was young, before we had cell phones and stuff, when I was young, we used to actually have rotary dial phones. You've probably never seen these before. One of my kids, we walked into someone's house. It was a very classy house, and they had a lot of antiques. So the phones to fit in were old phones. It was a rotary phone. One of my kids looks at me and says, cool, what type of phone is that? I said, it's an old phone. He says, but how does it work? I said, like this. He says, whoa, that's so cool. Like, he's like amazed by this rotary phone. I said, all phones used to be like that in us. He said, whoa, that's really cool. Anyway, but you see, in those days, you could not speed dial. There was no such thing as speed dial, right? So I remembered phone numbers. Now, I don't remember phone numbers. I remember, like, so-and-so is one, this is one, the person is two, this person is three, or I don't even have to remember that. Because now you've got voice numbers, like contacts, right? And I said, unfortunately, my phone's an anti-Semite. If I give Jewish names, they never recognize me. You know what I mean? I say, Chavi. Did you say Harry? I said, no, Chavi. Right? Did you say Johnny? No! But I'm yelling at people looking for me, like I'm screaming into my phone, like, that type of thing, because it must recognize Jewish names, filthy anti-Semite. Anyways, right, I'm ranting a little bit. So now, but in the ancient world, people used their memories. They developed advanced memory techniques. People have this impression, someone actually once told me this, a student of mine, or some said, you know what, this is his idea of how the oral law was transmitted. There's this old rabbi lying on his deathbed, and he says to his top student, he says, Shlomo, come here. Schleimler comes over and he says, yeah, what is it? He says, I'm going. He says, where are you going? He says, I'm dying, stupid. He says, oh, I'm sorry. He says, okay. He says, Schleimler, I've got to tell you the oral law. Schleimler says, now? He says, yeah, well, now. When else? Yeah. He says, okay, let me get a pen and paper. He says, hello, oral. He says, oh, I'm sorry. Right, so he tells him the entire oral law and then he dies. Schleimler waits till he's dying. Right, he calls over his top student and says, Duvin, come in. He can hardly wait to use the oral line, you know what I mean? He's been waiting his whole dying to do it. Anyway, but that's not how it works. Right? It did not work that way. You started teaching it when you were young, and we review it, and we have, you know, what, anyone know what a mnemonic device is? It's very simple stuff. People use it all the time. So the sages use those things. I mean, my very earnest mother just showed us nine planets, you know, Mercury, Venus, Earth, right? Mars just showed us nine planets, Jupiter, etc. We have to adjust that because now Pluto lost the status. So now there's actually either three Plutoids or whatever, doesn't it? Right? But there's all types of mnemonic devices to remember things. The sages, and in the ancient world it was common to commit a lot of things to memory, and they used to use tunes. You know, when you sing something, you remember it much better. I remember the most stupid stuff, right, from songs I learned in kindergarten, right? Alexander Beetle, for example. I won't sing it. Right, but in any case, right, we learn things and we use our memories in ancient times. Finally, number 3G, there was the inertia of an entire society. You see, during the time when the Torah was in fact oral, that is to say, before it was written down, where did the Jews live? Most of the Jews lived in, all Jews lived in Israel for most of that time. For some of the time, those Jews lived in Babylon. Now, in Babel and Israel, what was the law of the land? For the Jews in Babylon had autonomy. That means they had their own law, legal system. What was the law of the land in Israel and Babel? Anyone know? The legal system was Jewish law. Jewish law was the legal system. So that means, you know, you're driving along, sipping a coffee, policeman pulls you over. Excuse me, sir, is that coffee with milk? I say, yeah. He said, and is that a McDavid's burger? I say, yes. He said, do you mind breathing into the metalizer? I said, yeah, sure. 5.5 hours. I'm going to let go of the warning this time. Right? But I mean, I don't know if exactly that's how it was. You know, like, Pesach time, the neighbor smells bread in your house. They call Homeland Security. Right? The SWAT team surrounds the house. Come out with the bread in front of you. Don't pick it up. It's a Kenyan. Just kick it. Whatever. But in any case, you've got this idea that there was an entire society, an entire state, an entire country running according to the oral law. It's not so easy to forget it if that's the law of the land. If that is what is enforced, that's what the legal system is, you're not going to forget it. So therefore we have, therefore, quite a few security mechanisms that teach us and that show us how the oral law was kept secure even though it was oral. This brings us to the final point, number 4. Just hang in there a little bit long. Right? Number 4 is the final point, which is there any evidence from outside what I'm saying, any evidence for the antiquity of the oral law? There's a few points. First of all, there is a uniform acceptance of the basic principles, even by, anyone heard of the Karaites? The Karaites were Jews who rejected the oral law. They didn't hear my lecture, and as a result of that, they rejected the oral law. So the Karaites, however, what's interesting is, even amongst the Karaites, they accept certain principles of the oral law. They have no choice. Shechting, slaughtering an animal, they slaughter it exactly the same way as we do. Where do they get it from? Answer is, it's part of the oral law. There are artifacts that predate the writing down of the Mishnah. For example, the mikveh on Masada was built a few hundred years before the Mishnah was written down. What does the Torah say about mikveh? You know what the Torah says about mikveh? It says this. Ach, ma'ayam ubor mikveh mayim yihyeh tahor. Which means, however, a pit, a spring, and a collection of water shall be pure. That's it. From this, we're meant to figure out all the detailed laws of mikveh. What's interesting is, though, when Yigal Yadin, the great Israeli archaeologist, found the mikveh on Masada, it was the oldest mikveh ever found, and a whole bunch of rabbis from Jerusalem said, we want to come up and see if it's kosher. This is a rabbinic hobby to check if things are kosher. Right? If they find life on Mars, there'll be someone from the OU up there checking to see if it's kosher. Right? So these rabbis go to Masada, they check out the mikveh, Yigal Yadin writes, he was standing there wondering, will it be kosher, will it not be kosher? Because it was a fascinating test of how strong the oral law is. Because this mikveh was built hundreds of years before it was written down. And so therefore, and the rabbi said, shufra the shufra shivapa, which means best of the best, 7 times over. This big boat was considered to be Talmud, and they were judging it according to the 17th century code of Jewish law. 17th century code of Jewish law, and yet it was actually a kosher mikvah. The Dead Sea Scrolls very often reflect realities of the oral law when they talk about it. The Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Torah, usually translates things in accordance with the oral law. There is also, for example, a consistency of the Jewish calendar. Jews who have no contact with each other, communities all over the world, have the same calendar, very complex calendar. All the Torah says about our calendar is two things. It says, keep, guard the month of spring, and says, this month shall be the first of months. That's not exactly enough information to make a calendar with, right? But the oral law supplies it, and indeed what's interesting is all Jewish communities have that. Any Kohanim here? Kohen? No, what, no Kohen? Any Kohanim? No. A Kohen, okay, interesting. A Kohen is a Jew who believes that they are descended on their father's side from Aaron, the high priest, brother of Moses, 3,200 years ago. That's quite an impressive claim. Now, it's interesting, Jews from all over the world make this claim, and that's a purely oral tradition. So there was a scientist by the name of Skoretsky. I have the article here, but Skoretsky did a test of Jews, of Kohanim, in England, Israel, and the United States, and tested to see if he could find something in common. He found an incredible marker in the male chromosomes of the Kohanim, which existed in something like 80% of Kohanim, but in less than 20% of others. It was called the Kohen modal haplotype. And now, it's not like you look in the genes and it says Aaron was here. But what it means is, it's a remarkable confirmation of an oral tradition. Very, very impressive. Finally, there is something which Ashkenazim call cholot, and others call chamin, or risos, you know, what do you call, what do Bukharans call it? I didn't get that. That was too fast. Okay, so Orstavor, right, so it sounds awesome. Anyway, so Ashkenazim call it cholot, which comes from two French words, short, which means hot, lot, which means slow. Right, some call it chamin, which means hot. Some call it orissa. Now, what's interesting is, right, almost every Jewish community in the world has some form of orstavor, right? Just a bit. I mean, every Jewish community in the world has some form of this, right? The Jews of Calcutta in India have something which they make out of rice and curry and chicken. In Poland, it's made out of potatoes and beans. In Germany, it's made with dumpling. In Morocco, it is cracked wheat and garlic and napalm. Right? And no doubt, every community has their own recipe. And not only does every community have their own recipe, every family has their own recipe. And there are I don't want to get into it, but there's been some really nasty stuff happening over the great ketchup controversy. Right? Families split apart, which is the worst stuff. But in any case, I don't want to get into the sort of details. But, right, what's interesting is that the American Museum of Natural History has a magazine called Nature Magazine, and they feature an exotic food in the magazine. They once featured cholent as the exotic food of the month. I thought, fascinating. So this guy who wrote the article, he writes the following. He says, what is it that makes all of these dishes, what's in common with all of these dishes? The ingredients are not in common. The one thing's in common. What's the one thing in common? They're all designed to be put on the fire Friday afternoon before Shabbat, left on the fire until lunchtime, and eaten at lunchtime, correct?
Yes.
That's the one thing in common. The ingredients are wildly different. Okay. So he says, it's interesting, and the fact of the matter is, cholent or chamin is basically what I call a protest food. Why? Because the Karaites, who did not believe in the oral law, they read the Torah and it says, don't light a fire in your house on Shabbat. Don't light a fire on Shabbat. The way they understood it is, you're not allowed to have a fire burning on Shabbat. So that means in a Karaite family, the husband would go over to his wife as Shabbat's approaching and he'd say, honey, did you blow out the candles yet? It's almost Shabbat. Because you have to blow out the candles. You're not allowed to have a fire burning. So they'd sit in the dark, eat cold food and freeze. Right? That's why there's not that many Karaites around. Right? So, however, how did the rest of the Jews show that we believed in the oral law? How did we show that? We had food that was hot at lunchtime. The only way you can have hot food lunchtime is if you had it on the fire over Shabbat, overnight. If I have hot food Friday night, it doesn't prove anything, because maybe it was hot from before Shabbat. If I had hot food lunchtime, that proves it was cooking throughout Shabbat on a covered fire. Right? And what that means is it's a sign that I believe in the oral law. So well before marijuana, this was the ultimate protest food. Jews would sit around and say, like, dude, I just got this awesome chametz. Just like, you know, right? I just got this cholent from Poland. If you want to try it, man, it's really chilling. Right, exactly. You know, so, but it would be ultimately a protest food. And so therefore, the oral law is not only inscribed in the hearts and minds of the Jewish people, it is also inscribed on the very arteries of the Jewish people as well. So that brings us to the end. So we have covered our first question, which is the necessity of the oral law, which is to read, understand, and practice the Torah. The advantage of it being oral, to inscribe it on our hearts and minds, to learn the skills of life, to have contact with previous generations, to create a study ethic. We have also learned of the security mechanisms, what keeps it intact, multiple lines of transmission, making it the center of our lives, teaching it to our children from a very young age, and all these security mechanisms. And then we finally learnt that there are many, many pieces of evidence for the existence of the oral law and its antiquity and how widespread it is from outside of the Torah, all of which tell us that indeed, when we talk about Torah, we're not just talking about the written word, we're talking about the oral law, and that is the basic idea. Just end with one idea. You may have seen the two tablets of the law in synagogues all over the world. How are they shaped? Like that, yeah. Right? Now, the interesting thing is that historically that's incorrect, because all of the commentaries say they were square cubes. Why is it that synagogues all over the world have it round? I've heard all types of bizarre explanations. You know, some say because Michelangelo, in his statue of Moses, had them round. Does that make sense? Every rabbi in the world says, well, the Midrash says they're square, but Michelangelo says they're round, so let's make it. You know, or the rabbi says to the guy who's carving it, says, carve it square. And then the feng shui guy comes in and says, oh no, it's got to be round. You want the energy to flow from the art, not blocked by squares. Right? I mean, and the rabbi says, oh, fine. But I mean, it's ridiculous. So what's the answer? The answer is the verse in Mishlei, Proverbs, that says, Katvei aluach libcha. Write the words of Torah on the tablets of your heart. So when we look at the tablets in the synagogue and they're round, what we're seeing actually at the top half are the two rounded parts of the heart. Right, and the bottom is made of stone. Because where is the Torah written? It's not just written on stone, but it's also meant to be written on the hearts of the Jewish people. How is it written on our hearts? Through the oral law, through its study, and through its fulfillment. Thank you very much for listening. Okay.